The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. In addition, December's broadcasts of the week have been generously sponsored by Andrew and Heather Rook in honor of George Douglas. We wish to thank Andrew and Heather for their support. And we are reading this week from the December 31st, 2014 issue of the Week magazine. And I'll start with part of a note to the readers from William Falk, the editor-in-chief. He says, "Welcome to the special year-end issue of the Week. In this issue, we take you on a curated tour of an eventful year in news, business, and culture. Through our reading and analysis of hundreds of newspapers, magazines, and websites, we have selected the most notable trends and achievements in technology, health and science, books, music, art, and food. All of it, of course, is spiced with a bit of irreverent fun." And he has a PS on his note. To recharge our batteries, we are now taking some time off. Your next issue of the Week will be dated January 16 and begin arriving on January 9th. So we will spend the next 2 weeks going through this 2014 year-in-review issue, and we'll start with the year in the review, a month by month, broken down month by month. January. President Barack Obama begins his sixth year in office with approval ratings in the low 40s, dragged down in part by the Affordable Care Act, now universally known as Obamacare. So far, only 2.1 million Americans have signed up for health insurance under the program. Unless 7 million enroll by the end of March, says the Congressional Budget Office, the new system may collapse. A federal court in Oklahoma rules the state ban on same-sex marriage is an arbitrary, irrational exclusion of just one class of Oklahoma citizens from a governmental benefit, the first in a cascading series of federal court decisions in 2014 that declares gay marriage bans unconstitutional. In Iraq, fighters from an Islamic extremist group, the ambitiously named Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or ISIS, captured the cities of Fallujah and Ramadi, routing the U.S.-trained Iraqi army. Obama dismisses ISIS as a JV team of amateurs. February. In Washington, D.C., House Republicans unveil a draft plan for comprehensive immigration reform, with a bipartisan immigration bill having passed the Senate in 2013, there are new hopes of a resolution to an issue that has divided the parties and the GOP internally for decades. In Kiev, Ukraine, after months of huge protests against pro-Russian President Viktor Yanukovych, 28 protesters are shot dead by government forces. The killings push Ukraine to the brink of civil war, and its parliament votes to remove Yanukovych from office. Yanukovych flees Kiev for Russia, leaving opponents to swarm his opulent private estate, where they find a fleet of cars, a yacht dock, and a private zoo. March. Russian troops invade Ukraine and seize the Crimean Peninsula. Russian President Vladimir Putin defends the invasion as a humanitarian mission to defend Crimea's largely ethnic Russian population from the pro-Western rebels now holding power in Kiev. Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, carrying 227 passengers, takes off from Kuala Lumpur on a night flight to Beijing and disappears. Radar and satellite analysis show the plane making a bizarre series of course and altitude changes and heading south over the Indian Ocean. The plane's disappearance triggers a frenzy of speculation, with CNN leading the way with round-the-clock coverage. Anchor Don Lemon asks a panel of aviation experts if it's preposterous to think the plane may have been swallowed by a black hole. Well, it is, one replies. April. A last-minute surge in signups brings the total number of Obamacare enrollments to about 7 million, enough to ensure the program's fiscal viability. Armageddon has not arrived, says a relieved Obama in the White House Rose Garden. The Affordable Care Act is here to stay. Fresh violence erupts in Ukraine between government troops and pro-Russian rebels in the east of the country. Fighting alongside the rebels are a number of well-equipped troops wearing face masks and green uniforms with no insignia. These little green men are widely believed to be Russian special forces sent by Vladimir Putin to destabilize the region ahead of presidential elections scheduled for May. In Bunkerville, Nevada, hundreds of heavily armed conservatives and libertarians rushed to the defense of Cliven Bundy, 68, a desert rancher who has been illegally grazing 400 cattle on federal land. A brief, tense standoff ensues with federal troops who have come to seize Bundy's herd until the government backs down. Bundy's tenure as a populist hero ends when he muses aloud that the, quote, Negro would be better off as slaves, picking cotton and having a family life. May. Donald Sterling, 80, owner of the Los Angeles Clippers basketball team, receives a lifetime ban and a $2.5 million fine from the NBA after a recording surfaces of Sterling berating a former girlfriend for posting pictures of herself associating with black people on the internet. In Ukraine, Petro Poroshenko, a pro-Western former confectionery tycoon known affectionately as the Chocolate King, is elected the country's new president. Kanye West marries Kim Kardashian in a lavish ceremony at the Forte di Belvedere in Florence, Italy. In a gushing toast, West salutes his bride for being even more beautiful than I am talented. As ISIS's army captures territory in Iraq and Syria and threatens the Kurds, Obama calls the organization the principal threat in the Middle East. June. ISIS fighters seized the Iraqi city of Mosul and advanced to within 20 miles of Baghdad. In a shocking primary upset, House Majority Leader Eric Cantor loses his seat to Tea Party challenger David Brat. Reminded of the Tea Party's power, House Speaker John Boehner refuses even to allow a vote on a bipartisan immigration reform bill that passed the Senate in 2013. Boehner blames the failure of the bill on President Obama, who he claims cannot be trusted to enforce the bill's provisions, beefing up security on the southern border. On that border, meanwhile, a humanitarian crisis is developing as tens of thousands of young immigrants, most of them fleeing drug gang violence in Central America, are detained in squalid conditions as they await decisions by immigration officials on whether they qualify for asylum under U.S. law. Republicans demand that Obama deport the migrants. July. Three Israeli teenagers are kidnapped and murdered in the West Bank by members of the militant group Hamas. Israel retaliates with airstrikes against Hamas targets in Gaza. Hamas responds by stepping up its rocket attacks against Israel, prompting Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to order a full-scale Israeli ground invasion of Gaza. As the search for MH370 continues in the southern Indian Ocean, Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 is shot down over Ukraine, killing all 298 aboard, including 80 children. Minutes after the crash, a pro-Russian separatist leader boasts on social media of shooting down what he believed was a Ukrainian military plane. ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi makes a rare public appearance to declare that the territory seized by the group, stretching from western Syria to the outskirts of Baghdad, is now a unified Islamic caliphate. Let the world know that we are living in a new era, says al-Baghdadi. August. After 7 weeks of brutal fighting, Israel and Hamas agree to an Egyptian-brokered ceasefire. The conflict has displaced nearly 500,000 people and claimed the lives of some 2,200 Gazans, most of them civilians, as well as 70 Israelis, including 64 soldiers. 3 years after the withdrawal of U.S. forces, President Obama orders airstrikes against ISIS targets in Iraq. In Ferguson, Missouri, an unarmed black teenager, Michael Brown, is shot dead by a white police officer, Darren Wilson, sparking nights of angry protests and riots. In response to the protests, police deploy riot teams in camouflage, wielding automatic weapons and bomb-proof vehicles, sparking a new debate over equipping small-town police departments with military hardware. September. In a historic referendum, voters in Scotland reject independence from Great Britain by 55-45%. After ISIS releases a series of gruesome videos depicting the beheading of a captured American journalist, President Obama steps up attack on ISIS forces in Iraq and Syria. The campaign against ISIS is merely a counterterrorism operation, Obama insists, not a war. And the 1,600 U.S. military advisors now stationed in Iraq do not and will not have a combat mission. The NFL's image is badly tarnished by several domestic violence scandals after a video shows Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice knocking out his then-fiancée with a punch to the face, and Minnesota Vikings running back Adrian Peterson is indicted for allegedly whooping his 4-year-old son with a tree branch so hard it left him bloody and bruised. We will get our house in order, promises NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell. October. An Ebola epidemic in West Africa has now killed about 5,000 people, making it the deadliest outbreak of the disease in history. Ebola appears on U.S. soil for the first time when a Liberian man, Thomas Eric Duncan, 45, is hospitalized in Dallas while visiting family. As Duncan's condition worsens, two nurses caring for him become the first Americans infected with Ebola on U.S. soil. When Duncan dies in New York City, Dr. Craig Spencer returns from Guinea with the disease, there is a wave of hysteria, with some politicians blaming Obama for not banning all travel from West Africa. Defying the federal government and health officials, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie impose quarantines on all travelers returning from West Africa. Casey Hickox, a nurse who volunteered to treat Ebola patients in Sierra Leone, is forced into quarantine in New Jersey after getting off a plane. She's released when she threatens to sue Christie. The U.S. Supreme Court refuses to hear appeals from 5 states, Indiana, Oklahoma, Utah, Virginia, and Wisconsin, seeking to keep their bans on same-sex marriage in place. And in a flurry of rulings, gay marriage also becomes legal in Nevada, West Virginia, Idaho, North Carolina, Alaska, and Wyoming. November. In the midterm elections, Republicans exceed expectations, seizing control of the Senate and expanding their majority in the House. When the dust settles, the GOP holds 54 Senate seats to the Democrats' 46 and at least 246 House seats to the Democrats' 188. This means President Obama will face a largely hostile Congress in his final 2 years. In his post-election speech, Obama congratulates Republicans on a good night, but his magnanimity stops there. He acts unilaterally on immigration reform, using executive orders to shield up to 5 million illegal immigrants from the threat of deportation. Republicans are outraged, with Speaker Boehner saying the president's action will poison the well and ensure gridlock for another 2 years. A fresh wave of outrage erupts when videos surface of key Obamacare architect Jonathan Gruber saying that the lack of transparency in the law was really critical to getting it passed. In New York City, Craig Spencer is discharged from the hospital after weeks of treatment leave him free of Ebola. With two Dallas nurses also declared Ebola-free, the number of U.S. cases drops to zero, and the panic quickly fades. The nation is briefly distracted by photographs of a naked, oiled, and extravagantly voluptuous Kim Kardashian in Paper magazine, including one instantly iconic image taken from the rear. In Ferguson, a grand jury declines to indict Officer Darren Wilson in the death of Michael Brown. The decision sparks a night of rioting and more than a week of mostly peaceful protest across the nation. Black Lives Matter, protesters chant. December. The protests intensify after a New York City grand jury declines to indict another white policeman, Daniel Pataleo, for the death of yet another unarmed black man, Eric Garner. Pataleo placed Garner in a chokehold while arresting him for selling untaxed cigarettes. The new chant, "I can't breathe." An oil glut partly caused by U.S. fracking, causes price to plummet to $63 a barrel, down from $105 earlier in the year. Gas prices dropped to their lowest level in 5 years. Climatologists announced that 2014 will be the hottest year on record. The Senate Intelligence Committee releases a scathing report on the CIA's use of torture, saying its review of more than 6 million internal CIA documents shows the interrogation of detainees was far more brutal than previously disclosed and failed to provide any critical intelligence. Former Vice President Dick Cheney says the report is full of crap. A group of hackers working for North Korea launches a devastating cyber attack on Sony Pictures in retribution for Sony's planned release of The Interview, a satire in which Kim Jong-un is assassinated. When theater chains refuse to show the film, Sony cancels its release. Obama brings the year to a close with a stunning announcement. The U.S. will restore diplomatic relations with Raul Castro's Cuba. Isolation has not worked, Obama says. It's time for a new approach. And that, according to The Week, is the year in review. The review of the health and science stories are broken down in an interesting way. They have the big scientific breakthroughs of 2014, which we'll look at next week. But the other way is some of the things they said were good for us and some of the things we were told to avoid. So some of the things they said were good for us. Exercise helps stave off depression. Swedish researchers genetically engineered mice to have high levels of a protein that builds up muscles during exercise, then subjected those mice to a control group to sustain the low stress levels. After 5 weeks, the normal mice showed signs of depression, whereas the engineered mice did not. Coffee can improve memory, but don't drink too much. Researchers asked 160 people to look at pictures of objects. then gave them either a placebo or a tablet containing 200 milligrams of caffeine, equivalent to a strong cup of coffee. When the volunteers were shown a larger set of images on the next day and asked to identify which ones were old, new, or similar, the caffeinated group was more likely to recognize very slight changes in the pictures. Dosage was crucial, however. Researchers found that 100 milligram tablets didn't improve memory, while 300 milligram doses caused headaches and jitteriness. Standing up can delay the effects of aging. Swedish researchers split a group of men and women into two groups. Half were given a moderate exercise program and told to sit less. The other half continued their normal lives. After 6 months, scientists measured the volunteers' telomeres, caps on the ends of genes that generally shorten and fray with age. While the telomeres of subjects in the normal group had shortened, as expected, those in the active group had grown longer. Further tests confirmed that the biggest benefit didn't come from exercise, but from time spent simply standing up. Eating vegetables reduces your risk of dying. Tracking the eating habits of 65,000 people over 12 years, researchers found that those who consumed 7 or more portions a day, roughly half a cup each of fruits or vegetables, reduced their risk of death 42%. Fresh vegetables were the most beneficial, with each portion reducing overall risk of death 16%. Even minimal consumption helped, with 1 to 3 daily portions cutting the risk of death 14%. Consuming canned fruits, however, increased the statistical risk, probably because of the added sugar used in processing. Living in Utah makes you happy. Residents of Provo Orem, 40 miles south of Salt Lake City, reported the highest level of contentment in the U.S. last year. The results from the latest Gallup survey, which rates the well-being of residents in 189 metropolitan areas, found people's overall happiness to be higher in the Midwest and West and lower in the South. The Ashland-Huntington area, where Ohio, Kentucky, and West Virginia meet, came in last. The poll is based on more than 500,000 interviews covering everything from physical health to job satisfaction. Fist bumping instead of shaking hands helps prevent the spread of bacteria. Researchers in Britain carried out a simple experiment. Wearing sterile gloves, they dunked their hands into a mild solution of E. coli bacteria, then shook hands, high-fived, or fist-bumped someone wearing uncontaminated gloves. The team found that a handshake transferred about twice as much bacteria as a high-five and about 10 times more than a fist-bump. Low expectations boost happiness. When researchers monitored the brain activity of volunteers as they played a game, they found the degree of happiness players experienced when they won depended on their expectations. The lower the expectations, the happier they were about winning. In the real world, scientists say, people with low expectations are likely to derive more pleasure from receiving gifts or going on vacation. Happiness depends not on how well things are going, says neuroscientist Rob Rutledge, but whether things are going better or worse than expected. And some of the things we were told to avoid. Too much sugar is a primary cause of obesity, diabetes, and tooth decay, said new guidelines from the World Health Organization. Called for a sharp reduction in the amount of added or free sugars in the typical diet. Sugars account for 15% of the average American's daily caloric intake, and the WHO recommends that number be reduced to no more than 5%, or roughly 25 grams, 6 teaspoons per day. That's less than what's found in a single can of soda. Free sugars are found in white and brown sugar, honey, maple syrup, and additives like high fructose corn syrup. The key point is that we are consuming way too much added sugars for good health. Artificial sweeteners may be just as bad. A new study indicates the additives can alter the body's metabolism to make weight gain more likely. Researchers at Israel's Weizmann Institute of Science found that three sweeteners widely used in low-calorie snacks and drinks, saccharin, sucralose, and aspartame, raised blood sugar levels in mice, increasing their risk of glucose intolerance, a condition linked to obesity and diabetes. Sweeteners, the report found, may have directly contributed to enhancing the exact epidemic that they were intended to fight. Pot smoking can damage developing brains. Today's more potent strains, in fact, can cause structural changes in a key region of the brain of people younger than 26, especially if they smoke daily. Levels of THC, marijuana's psychoactive compound, have increased in weed from an average of 3.75% in 1995 to 13% in 2013. Scientists believe that the increased potency leads to abnormalities in shape, density, and volume of the nucleus accumbens, the walnut-shaped area of the brain that's associated with pleasure and pain. The nucleus accumbens is the core of motivation, says study co-author Hans Breiter. This is the part of the brain you do not want to mess around with. Pop stardom leads to an early grave, an Australian study has revealed. Sydney University professor Diana Kenny looked at more than 12,000 popular musicians who died from 1950 to 2014 and found that their lifespans were roughly 25 years shorter than the average Americans. Although substance abuse contributed to the early deaths, musicians were also much more likely to die in accidents, commit suicide, or be murdered. Those who avoided such pitfalls still tended to die young, in their 50s and 60s rather than their 70s and 80s, like most non-performers. The culprit, says Kenny, is a culture that glorifies outrageous behavior by emotionally immature artists. The pop scene is toxic and needs rehabilitation, says Kenny. Playing football damages brains, even in players who don't suffer concussions. Studies have shown that at least one-third of NFL players will develop some form of cognitive disorder. And new research indicates the negative effects can already be seen in the brains of high school players. Scientists at Wake Forest University tracked a high school team for one season and found measurable abnormalities similar to the effects of mild traumatic brain injuries in all 24 players they studied. For every one NFL player, there are 2,000 high school players, says study author Christopher Whitlow. It's a really understudied population. Low vitamin D level can increase the risk of Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia. UK researchers studied more than 1,600 adults and found that those with vitamin D levels below 50 nanomoles per liter, the minimum healthy level, were up to 2 times more likely to suffer from dementia than those with higher levels. We can't say anything about whether people should be supplementing because that's beyond the scope of what we looked at, said study co-author Ian Lang. But these are exciting and suggestive results. And finally, an unhappy marriage can break your heart, literally. A new study from sociologists at Michigan State University indicates that people in contentious marriages are much more likely to develop heart disease or suffer a heart attack or stroke than their more happily wed contemporaries. Previous research has shown that married people tend to be healthier overall, but this study found that the stress of an unhappy union outweighs the usual benefits of wedlock. It's not that every marriage is better than none, says study author Hui Liu. The quality of marriage is really important. Our year-end review also contains what they call three great reads from 2014, in-depth articles like our section usually called The Last Word. We'll take one of them this week and see what we can get to next week. The first, what wealth does to your soul. Getting rich won't make you happy, said Michael Lewis, but it will make you more selfish and dishonest. When I was 14, I met a man with a talent for restoring a sense of fairness to society with vast and growing inequalities in wealth. His name was Jack Kenny, and he'd created a tennis camp called Tamarack in the mountains of northern New Hampshire. The kids who went to Tamarack Tennis Camp mostly came from well-to-do East Coast families, but the camp itself didn't feel like a rich person's place. It wasn't unusual for the local health inspectors to warn the camp about its conditions, or for the mother of some Boston Brahmin dropping her child off and seeing where he would sleep and eat for the next month to burst into tears. Kenny himself had enjoyed a brief, exotic career as a professional tennis player. He'd even played a doubles match on ice with Fred Perry. But he was pushing 60, and he had long since abandoned whatever interest he'd had in fame and fortune. He ran his tennis camp less as a factory for future champions than as an antidote to American materialism, and also to the idea that a person could be at once successful and selfish. You can still hear his quixotic suspicion of conventional success echoed in his grandson, the Olympic champion Bodie Miller, who grew up on the campsite. Jack Kenny's assault on teenaged American inequality began at breakfast the first morning. The bell clanged early, and the kids all rolled out of their old stained bunk beds, scratched their fresh mosquito bites, and crawled to the dining hall. On each table were small boxes of cereal, enough for each kid to have one box, but not enough that everyone could have the brand of cereal he wanted. There were Fruit Loops and Cheerios, but also more than a few boxes of the deadly dark brand stuff consumed willingly only by old people suffering from constipation. On the second morning, when the breakfast bell clanged, a mad foot race ensued. Kids sprung from their bunks and shot from their cabins in the New Hampshire woods to the dining hall. The winners got the Fruit Loops, the losers a laxative. By the third morning, it was clear that, in the race to the Fruit Loops, some kids had a natural advantage. They were bigger and faster, or their cabins were closer to the dining hall, or they just had that special knack some people have for getting whatever they want. Some kids would always get the Fruit Loops, and others would always get the laxative. Life was now officially unfair. After the third breakfast, Kenny called an assembly on a hill overlooking a tennis court. He was unkempt and a bit odd. Wisps of gray hair crossed his forehead, and he looked as if he hadn't bathed in a week. He was also kind and gentle and funny, and kids instantly sensed that he was worth listening to and wanted to hear what he had to say. "You all live in important places surrounded by important people," he'd begin. "When I'm in the big city, I never understand the faces of the people, especially the people who want to be successful. They look so worried, so unsatisfied." Here his eyes closed shut and his hands became lobster claws, pinching and grasping the air in front of him. "In a city, you see people grasping, 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 taking, 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 and it must be so hard to always be grasping, grasping, and taking, taking. But no matter how much they have, they never have enough. They're still worried about what they don't have. They're always empty." Eyes closed, talking as much to himself as to us, he described the life of not-so-quiet desperation until every kid on the hill wondered what this had to do with the two-handed backhand. Then he opened his eyes and finished. You have a choice. You don't realize it, but you have a choice. You can be a giver, or you can be a taker. You can get filled up or empty. You make that choice every day. You make that choice at breakfast when you rush to grab the cereal you want so others can't have what they want. And then he moved on to why no one should ever hit a two-handed backhand, while every kid on the hill squirmed and reddened and glanced at one another, wondering if everyone realized what an a-hole he'd been. On the fourth morning, no one ate the Fruit Loops. Kids were thrusting the colorful boxes at each other and leaping on the constipation cereal like war heroes jumping on hand grenades. In a stroke, the texture of life in this tennis camp had changed, from a chapter out of Lord of the Flies to the feeling between the lines of Walden. Even the most fantastically selfish kids did what they could to contribute to the general welfare of the place, and there was not a shred of doubt that everyone felt happier for it. The distinction between haves and have-nots, winners and losers, wasn't entirely gone, of course, but it became less important than this other distinction between the givers and the takers. What is clear about rich people and their money, and becoming even clearer, is how it changes them. A body of quirky but persuasive research has sought to understand the effects of wealth and privilege on human behavior, and any future book about the nature of billionaires would do well to consult it. One especially fertile source is the University of California at Berkeley Psychology Department lab overseen by a professor named Dacher Keltner. In one study, Keltner and his colleague Paul Piff installed note takers and cameras at city street intersections with four-way stop signs. The people driving expensive cars were four times more likely to cut in front of other drivers than drivers of cheap cars. The researchers then followed the drivers to the city's crosswalks and positioned themselves as pedestrians, waiting to cross the street. The drivers in the cheap cars all respected the pedestrians' right of way. The drivers in the expensive cars ignored the pedestrians 46.2% of the time, a finding that was replicated in spirit by another team of researchers in Manhattan, who found that drivers of expensive cars were far more likely to double park. In yet another study, the Berkeley researchers invited a cross-section of the population into their lab and marched them through a series of tasks. Upon leaving the laboratory testing room, the subjects passed a big jar of candy. The richer the person, the more likely he was to reach in and take candy from the jar, and ignore the big sign on the jar that said the candy was for the children who passed through the department. Maybe my favorite study done by the Berkeley team rigged a game with cash prizes in favor of one of the players, and then showed how that person, as he grows richer, becomes more likely to cheat. In his forthcoming book on power, Keltner contemplates his findings. If I have $100,000 in my bank account, winning $50 alters my personal wealth in trivial fashion. It just isn't that big of a deal. If I have $84 in my bank account, winning $50 not only changes my personal wealth significantly, it matters in terms of the quality of my life. The extra $50 changes what bill I might be able to pay, what I might put in my refrigerator at the end of the month, the kind of date I would get out on, or whether or not I could buy a beer for a friend. The value of winning $50 is greater for the poor, and by implication, the incentive for lying in our study greater. Yet it was our wealthy participants who were far more likely to lie for the chance of winning $50. There is plenty more like this to be found, if you look for it. A team of researchers at New York State Psychiatric Institute surveyed 43,000 Americans and found that, by some wide margin, the rich were more likely to shoplift than the poor. Another study by a coalition of nonprofits called the Independent Sector revealed that people with incomes below 25 grand give away on average 4.2% of their income, while those earning more than 150 grand give away only 2.7%. A UCLA neuroscientist named Keely Muscatel has published an interesting paper showing that wealth quiets the nerves in the brains associated with empathy. If you show rich people and poor people pictures of kids with cancer, the poor people's brains exhibit a great deal more activity than the rich people's. An inability to empathize with others has just got to be a disadvantage for any rich person seeking political office, at least outside of New York City. As you move up the class ladder, said Keltner, you are more likely to violate the rules of the road, to lie, to cheat, to take candy from kids, to shoplift, and to be tight-fisted in giving to others. Straightforward economic analyses have trouble making sense of this pattern of results. There is an obvious chicken and egg question to ask here, but it is beginning to seem that the problem isn't that the kind of people who wind up on the pleasant side of inequality suffer from some moral disability that gives them a market edge. The problem is caused by the inequality itself. It triggers a chemical reaction in the privileged few. It tilts their brains. It causes them to be less likely to care about anyone but themselves or to experience the moral sentiments needed to be a decent citizen, or even a happy one. Not long ago, an enterprising professor at the Harvard Business School named Mike Norton persuaded a big investment bank to let him survey the bank's rich clients. The poor people in the survey were millionaires. In a forthcoming paper, Norton and his colleagues tracked the effects of getting money on the happiness of people who already have a lot of it. A rich person getting even richer experiences zero gain in happiness. That's not all that surprising. It's what Norton asked next that led to an interesting insight. He asked these rich people how happy they were at any given moment. Then he asked them how much money they would need to be even happier. All of them said they needed two or three times more than they had to feel happier, said Norton. The evidence overwhelmingly suggests that money above a certain modest sum does not have the power to buy happiness. And yet even very rich people continue to believe that it does. The happiness will come from the money they don't have yet. To the general rule that money above a certain low level cannot buy happiness, there is one exception. While spending money upon oneself does nothing for one's happiness, said Norton, spending it on others increases happiness. If the Harvard Business School is now making a home for research exposing the folly of a life devoted to endless material ambition, something in the world has changed, or is changing. And I think it is. There is a growing awareness that the yawning gap between rich and poor is no longer a matter of simple justice, but also the enemy of economic success and human happiness. It's not just bad for the poor. It's also bad for the rich. It's funny when you think about it, how many rich people don't know this. But they are not idiots. They can learn. Many even possess the self-awareness to correct for whatever tricks their brain chemicals seek to play on them. Some of them already do it. When you control a lot more than your share of the Fruit Loops, there really isn't much doubt about whether what you should do with them for your own good. You just need to be reminded, loudly and often. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the New Republic. We'll turn now to business. We have the five biggest business stories of 2014. A roller coaster year for stocks. If 2013 was a banner year for stocks, 2014 was a roller coaster. Strong corporate earnings and a relatively stable global economy helped push the Dow Jones Industrial Average above a record 17,900, while the S&P surpassed 2,000 for the first time ever. But the second half of the year was particularly volatile. Nearly all of the market's gains for the year were erased in October, driven by fears over Ebola, tensions between Russia and Ukraine, and uncertainty over the Federal Reserve's action on interest rates. Stocks came back strongly in the final weeks of the year, but continued to seesaw. That has strengthened concerns that markets are headed for an overdue correction in 2015. In particular, bearish investors remain wary about the risk of a tech bubble, citing billion-dollar valuations on profitless Silicon Valley firms, a flurry of deal activity in the technology and biotech industries, and sky-high NASDAQ prices that haven't been seen since the first dot-com boom. Tax inversions take off. Complex deals known as tax inversions became one of the hottest trends in corporate finance this year, and one of the most controversial. More than a dozen major companies attempted to buy smaller foreign rivals and relocate overseas to locate their U.S. to lower their U.S. tax bills. More than had attempted the accounting maneuver in the previous 3 years combined. Inversions were particularly popular in the pharmaceutical industry, but companies like Burger King, which is set to buy Canadian coffee and donuts chain Tim Hortons and relocate north of the border, and the Chiquita Banana conglomerate also joined the wave. The practice drew withering criticism from U.S. lawmakers and federal officials, who say inversions robbed the U.S. government of corporate tax revenue. In July, Secretary Jack Lew called the deals unpatriotic. To slow the corporate exodus, the Treasury Department announced new rules in September that make it tougher and less attractive for companies to complete inversions, effectively scuttling several major deals, including Chicago-based pharmaceuticals giant AbbVie's $54 billion purchase of British drug maker Shire. The Fed ends its bond buying. After 6 years and more than $4 trillion, the Federal Reserve announced an end to its massive bond buying program known as quantitative easing in October, a sign that the central bank believes the U.S. economy is improving. Originally conceived as a $600 billion emergency measure to prop up the housing market after the 2008 financial crash, the program was renewed in 2010 and again in 2014 to stimulate a still struggling U.S. economy. At one point, the central bank was pumping $85 billion into markets each month. The U.S. economy is far stronger today than the darkest days of the recession. The stock market has soared to new heights, and job creation has quickened. But even supporters of the Fed spending spree say that its precise effects are hard to assess. Some critics say the program has exacerbated economic inequality by helping to dramatically lift financial markets while the rest of the economy plods along. Now that the Fed has officially wound down its purchases, all eyes have shifted to interest rates, which the Fed has signaled it could start raising from their current near-zero levels sometime next year. Hiring picks up, but wages stagnate. The economic recovery steamed ahead this year as the U.S. economy continued a 50-month streak of job creation, the longest since World War II. The unemployment rate fell throughout the year. It currently stands at 5.8%, down from 7% a year earlier and 7.8% in December 2012. After the economy unexpectedly contracted earlier in the year, owing to a particularly severe winter, growth came back strongly in the summer and fall, driven by increases in consumer spending and business investment. The period from April to September was the strongest six-month performance for the economy in more than a decade. But many Americans still don't feel as if they are reaping the rewards. job gains haven't translated into higher wages. 65% of the private sector jobs created in the last 5 years pay hourly wages of $20 or less. And since bosses in many industries aren't struggling to find workers to fill available jobs, they don't yet feel the need to offer raises. General Motors record recall. General Motors began the year by making car industry history, naming Mary Barra, a 34-year-old GM veteran, as the first female CEO of a global car manufacturer. The celebrating didn't last long. Just weeks into Barra's tenure, GM announced the first of a series of vehicle recalls related to faulty ignition switches in its Chevy Cobalt cars and other models. Ultimately, the automaker recalled more than 30 million vehicles worldwide for various defects, a record for a U.S. car manufacturer in a single calendar year. More than 40 deaths have now been linked to the faulty ignition switches, and hundreds of accidents are being investigated. Barra and other GM executives were hauled before a series of congressional panels and grilled over why GM hadn't acted sooner to fix the defect, and a federal criminal probe is ongoing. The scandal could ultimately cost GM hundreds of millions of dollars in fines and damage on top of its tarnished reputation. In the art section, they do their year in review by taking a critic's choice, the best of 2014, and they pick five nonfiction books and five fiction books. We'll take a look at a couple of the nonfiction books today. Number one, critic's choice nonfiction book, Can't We Talk About Something More Pleasant by Roz Chast. There's no experience that's more awful and more universal than the stumble toward the grave, said Douglas Walk in the Los Angeles Times. Yet as Roz Chast learned firsthand, the human capacity for denying the inevitable offers rich comic material. Chast's cartoons count among the reliable pleasures of the New Yorker. And in this graphic memoir, she brought a bitingly self-aware kind of comedy to describing her attempts to care for her parents through their last years of life. Chast's signature ice cream pastels and jittery lines convey her anxiety as mountains of legal paperwork or outrageous nursing home expenses add to the burden of saying goodbye, says Holly Silva in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Anyone who has had Chast's experience will devour this book and cling to it for truth, understanding, and the futile wish that it could all be different. And as a dissent, Chast's naive drawing style is arguably a mismatch for such a serious subject, said Hillary Brown in Pace.com. The number two critic's choice for nonfiction is called The Sixth Extinction, by Elizabeth Colbert. That's K-O-L-B-E-R-T. Read Elizabeth Colbert's riveting new book, and your view of the world will be fundamentally changed, said Marianne Gwynn in the Seattle Times. The New Yorker staff writer traveled to four continents to deepen her understanding of how human activity is causing a mass extinction unlike any since the dinosaurs. And the discoveries she makes are alarming. Colbert does not chide or condemn. She even manages to find humor in her subject matter. But she knows how just by leading our lives, we are contributing to the warming of the planet, to the spread of invasive species, and to the forces that may soon exterminate up to 30% of all species, ultimately threatening our own. The scariest news is that it may not matter if we recognize the damage we're causing, said Verlin Klinkenborg in the New York Review of Books. Caring and not caring don't alter gross systemic changes that are forcing extinctions. A dissent. Colbert misses a few chances to emphasize how much we as humans depend on the planet's biodiversity, said the economist. In a section called Farewell, they give us a long list of the notable folks who died this year. And we'll take a few, broken into sections, we'll take a few of those this week and a few next week. Among those who died in 2014, from the media and publishing category, Amiri Baraka, radical playwright and poet. Gloria Leonard, porn star turned high society publisher. Peter Matheson, author of The Snow Leopard. Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Nobel Prize winning author of 100 Years of Solitude. Maya Angelou, poet and activist. Casey Kasem, host of American Top 40. Felix Dennis, founder of Dennis Publishing, owner of The Week magazine. Nadine Gorimer, Nobel Prize winning novelist who had challenged apartheid in South Africa. Ben Bradley, editor of The Washington Post, who oversaw the Watergate coverage. Tom Magliozzi, co-host of NPR's Car Talk. P.D. James, British crime writer. Stage and screen, Maximilian Schell, Austrian-born actor who starred in Judgment at Nuremberg. Philip Seymour Hoffman, Oscar-winning star of Capote and the Master. Shirley Temple Black, child star and U.S. ambassador. And we'll return to that list next week. That's all we have time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. The program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138.